Every time I'm lucky enough to be working on a film set, I can't help but marvel that any of it is happening at all. Not because acting in movies and TV shows was a dream I had as a young boy and I can't believe it's actually happening. I mean, it is because of that. But what I'm specifically talking about in this context is my absolute amazement that anybody ever manages to actually get one of these things made. If you've ever begun to attempt the process of putting a legit film together, not a homemade thing you shoot on your phone and edit with iMovie, but an actual narrative feature-length motion picture shot on a camera that costs as much as a down payment for a nice home using top-of-the-line lighting and sound equipment, you know something about what an absolutely gargantuan task that really is. And it's not just hard for indie filmmakers. Indie filmmakers obviously face way more financial roadblocks than a team approaching a big studio project would. But no matter who is funding the venture, there are so many difficult hurdles a project has to surpass before getting to day one of principal photography. Just do a quick Google search of projects that got stuck in development hell, and you'll see a graveyard of would-be films that traded hands between 13 screenwriters and 2 dozen directors over the course of 10 years before finally landing in the trash heap next to all of the other once promising ideas that never made their way in front of an actual camera. There are so many people that need to collectively sign off on an idea before fundraising can even begin. So many people that need to buy in and actively try to get on the same page. Too many conflicting ideas or perspectives with no ability to compromise will sink a project before it even has a chance to begin every time. And in an industry where big egos are just kind of part of the territory, it's a miracle that enough people ever agree to enough terms to see one of these things to fruition. And that's what I stand in awe of on a film set. The fact that the project we are currently filming has somehow traversed the absolute minefield of pre-production, somehow secured the seemingly impossible budgetary demands, somehow gotten the approval of every investor and the creative excitement of important collaborators in all the different departments, somehow secured the locations and locked in the schedules in order to get to a place where shooting is actually taking place. And the most remarkable thing is that the real work at that point is only just getting started. Recently, I was lucky enough to find myself back on set shooting a film in a year where many artists have unfortunately had their creative lives put on hold. It was a low-budget indie feature called Alien Country, and it was the most fun I've had on a movie set, well, ever. And while this feature definitely had its fair share of investors and people who came together to ensure that it actually was going to be a project that saw the business end of a camera, the entire thing was really being glued together, seemingly by force of sheer will alone, from its two key creative components, Rennie Grames and Boston McConaughey. The married couple who was pulling double, triple, and quadruple duty, taking on the various roles of screenwriter, director, producer, and lead actor between the two of them. They were able to find a moment to breathe after wrapping principal photography and before heading into the still massive process of post-production to talk to me about their movie and about the long journey from the initial seed of an idea to several years later turning in the rented lenses they had used to get their story in the can. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to Boston McConaughey and Rennie Grames about the making of their indie sci-fi comedy, Alien Country.
What I love is that your microphone, I can't tell if it's just perspective or if it's actually as large as your head.
No, it is. It's the largest thing in the world. It is so comically huge. And I always tell people, I'm like, sorry, most, especially when we're doing it over Zoom, I'm like, most of the time you're going to see half of my face.
We just see your dimple and your right eye.
Right. It's this thing that I bought that I love. It's such a weird and unseemly and unsightly thing. I think people prefer the little shells because it's just like more, it just looks better and it looks more professional.
Right.
But this thing works better. It is, it's a giant foam casing that just goes around your microphone and basically puts the entire microphone in its own little like studio. And it cuts out everything.
So you can really record anywhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what room you're in.
Yeah, there's a little opening in the front here that my voice needs to go straight into. And then
maybe we should get one of those.
That sounds great.
It's incredible. And like my audio engineer who mixes my show, when I first got this, he was like, "Did you buy a new microphone?" I was like, "No, but I got a thing that really, really upped the quality of my
We used a condenser mic for a while, and then my buddy, who's a recording engineer composer, was like, came over, and we had this one shotgun mic that we used like on our YouTube videos, and he was like, "Oh, use that. That's what everyone uses." He's like, "This is the exact mic that everyone buys to do like voiceover or whatever." And I was like, "Really? It's a shotgun mic, though. I thought I was supposed to." Anyway, so that's what we've been using since that time. So, and I guess it's getting better audio. I don't know.
Is it like a Zoom or what is it?
It's the Sennheiser. No, I don't know. Some bunch of numbers. The MKH416P48. You know, that one.
Oh, yeah. The old MKH4148.
Yeah. Handy dandy.
Mm-hmm. I don't actually know microphones. I do this stuff, and my audio engineer is always trying to, like, send me different things to look at. He's always like, "You need to get this... this preamp or this like this audio interface." He's like, "This is going to change your game." And he like tells me all the reasons why. And I'm just like, "I don't know anything that you just said, but I believe you. And I don't know if I'll actually go out and buy that thing." But
the hard part is like, I want, like, I am like a tech minded person. And then I'll try to like listen to somebody, explain something. And they're like, "Well, the thing about the omnidirectional microphones is that you're going to run into this and the bell curve." And then I'm just like, "Oh, no, no, no." My brain shuts off.
And gone. And zoned out. Yep.
Oh man. That's what happens to me too. That's why I have a good partnership going with my guy. We used to be in a band together for years, and now he like is really into mixing and mastering and like all the like technical ins and outs of the audio engineering side of like making music, and like he mixes the podcast for me and stuff. And I just like production. I like putting together the arrangement and like playing the instruments and doing all that end. But like, he keeps trying to explain to me how he does what he does so that I don't have to be so reliant on him. He's like, "It's really not that hard." And every time he tries to explain it to me, my brain just turns to mush.
You're like, "What you don't understand is that I like you doing the
Chris, that sounds like a your job."
I'm like, "It sounds like you enjoy it and you like learning this stuff. And it makes sense to you. And to me, it doesn't make sense. And I hate it." But
I hate it.
I hate doing it. So we should keep our arrangement the way it is. And he's going to hear this. So yeah, Chris, just stay in your lane, bud, and keep doing what you do.
Got vision up the butt. Just go with it.
So tell me about yourselves. I mean, we just worked together for several weeks in a row, but like, I don't know if I know exactly like the story here of like, where are you from? How you meet, let's get the background first.
All right. Great. And Rennie, go for it.
Rennie. well, I'm a Jersey girl. I grew up in Jersey.
No way.
And, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Doesn't that like click for you? Most people are like, "Oh, that makes sense."
But you're both East Coast people?
Yeah.
Whoa, that's crazy.
East Coasters.
Blonde East Coasters who met in Utah County.
Right.
It's actually true.
Well, technically we met in Salt Lake County.
Was it Salt Lake County?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so can we keep going?
In fact, we now live about like 15 minutes from where we met, and we met on a movie set.
Yeah. We met on a movie set. I originally was a theater girl. I majored in theater and then discovered film and made the switch. I just love film so much. And
you gotta get closer to this microphone.
I need to get closer.
I keep leaning back, imagining that
I just need to lean closer.
I don't want it to be like I'm super loud and you're super quiet, but anyway.
Yeah. And 9 years ago, I auditioned for a little movie that a bunch of people here locally were putting together, and I played a sassy nurse, and here we are. Fast forward 10 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was a little indie film. Anyway, but the definitely the best thing that came out of it was the story that I like to tell, of course, is that, yeah, the film, to give you the scope of like how it went, I was DIT. Basically, I was in charge of taking the footage off of the camera, backing it up to hard drives. That's all my responsibility was for this film. And I'd spent the whole day waiting at lunch. I was waiting for cards to arrive. They never show up. And I asked like, oh, where are we? What's going on? And they're like, well, we've only gotten three shots off. And I was like, three shots or like three setups. And they're like, no, three shots. So in 6 hours, they had done three takes. And I was like, oh, okay, well, let me talk to the AD. And they're like, oh, yeah, we don't have one of those. And I was like, oh.
It was that kind of
movie. Okay.
Very small.
I mean, I just got out of film school. I could probably AD. I've sort of done that before. All right, let's do it. And so I became the first AD for this show.
It's so funny to me that they would have DIT, but they wouldn't have a first AD.
Not an AD.
Yeah. No, well... Yeah, I guess they did have somebody lined up, and that person like quit like 3 days before, and they weren't able to fill the position type of a thing. So yeah. I was like, oh, okay. So anyway, I was the first AD. So I was like literally just reading the script pages like the morning of or the day before, and just going, okay, I guess we're covering this scene today. You know, da, 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 da. And then like of course the best thing though is the last day of shooting. And it was only 2 week schedule. The director's wife went into labor with their first child, and so he's like, all right, you're directing now. Yeah, and I was like, great. I'm glad I read the script over the weekend, so I know what to what's generally the idea of what's supposed to happen. Anyway, long and the short of it is, the movie turned out fantastic.
Yeah.
No.
Although we found a super fan of that movie.
Yeah.
Literally, like 2 weeks ago on set. There is a super
fan of that movie.
I don't know if that's true.
It's called Misconnections. Don't Google it. But the point is,
Googling it right now.
Everyone is now.
The best thing that really came out of that movie was the fact that we got to meet each other, and and that was a few years ago now. But yeah, we've just started making movies together.
It was 9 years ago.
Okay, we don't have to just like put a date on it, you know?
Boston, you're also from the East Coast, right?
Yeah, yeah. I grew up in Duxbury, Massachusetts, which if you just want to get an image of what it's like, just imagine where the Kennedys grew up. That's it.
Wow, Duxbury.
Duxbury.
Whoa. How do they say it? Do they Duxbury? Say like Duxbury? Yeah. Duxbury.
Bury for sure. Yeah, I don't know if Duxbury.
Wow.
But it's a very much a hoity-toity rich town, and we used to get teased by all the other, well, let's just call it the blue collar towns, you know?
Yeah.
The lower class. Uh-huh. No, they would call it Deluxbury. But to be honest, it wasn't like everybody in the town was a millionaire, you know, it was still like, you know, middle class or upper middle class, whatever. But at the end of the day,
lots of polo shirts.
Yeah. I get so surprised now because it's been long enough since I left my hometown that I like look at photos of kids from high school and I'm like, man, I was so white. I didn't realize how crazy white my upbringing was, like yacht clubs. And I was on a sailing team, man. Oh boy. Yeah.
Anyway. Oh, you're over there in Deluxbury, huh?
Yeah, Deluxbury brats.
On the yacht club, on the sailing club.
No, yes, we are on the sailing club.
Wow. Anyway.
Yeah. So, but actually, I did grow up sailing. That was really fun. And so that's one thing I sort of miss. Interestingly enough, like a few years ago, my buddy, he got really into sailing. You can sail in Utah, but it's lake sailing, so it's not like as intense as like out on the ocean where you can hit, you know, really fast winds and stuff. But we went out to Deer Creek, no, Strawberry Reservoir. Well, I don't remember. Anyway, someplace up in middle of Utah, and and we're sitting there, and this girl pulls up, and she's like, I guess on some kind of exchange program, and she's from Boston, and like everything just looked like her life jacket, her accent, like her hat. She just like might as well have been from my hometown, because she just comes out. She's like, hey, how you doing out here? And I'm just like, fine, I guess. Where are you from? She's like, ah, Duxbury. No, anyway.
Duxbury.
No, but yeah, it's anyway. But very pervasive sailing culture.
Are there many Mormons out in Duxbury?
No. There was me and Clark.
Okay. Maybe not many in New Jersey either. Are any?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It was me and Emily.
Yeah.
She's like, it was me and Clark. It was
yeah. Clark would drive down from Clark Boston.
Clark would he was kind of the go-between.
Clark moved away senior year, so then it was just me.
But the two of you is BYU what gets you in Utah? Each of you?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, technically, my parents moved here to retire. They moved to the mountains to retire.
Okay.
And I just happened to be graduating high school around that time. They did a little stint in Japan. It's a kind of a long story, but I finished up high school in Japan, moved to Utah to go to BYU, and just stayed here.
Your parents are like always in Japan, right? They're like always doing Japan stuff.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I was born there. If we want to get technical about it.
Yeah.
But.
And then one other thing. I heard on set that Boston is a nickname. Is that true? Or
Yeah. My first name is Scott.
Okay.
But like it was one of those things too where Facebook, you know, just basically started when I was a freshman in college. There are like 16 colleges. And so I started a Facebook profile, but everyone was calling me in my like freshman dorm. Boston, because there were four Scots in the same building, and it wasn't a big building, you know, it was like six apartments or something. It happened to be out of the 24 people, you know, one sixth of them were named Scott. And so they're like, oh, it's the Boston Scott. And again, it was around the time that I think Boston Rob had won the first season of Survivor. And he was like, I don't want to be like associated with Survivor, cause I don't really watch that shit. Anyway. So it was, I was like, just call me Boston or Scott, one or the other. And so I got Boston, I created a profile and I couldn't escape it. And that was our dog. Well, our in-laws,
yeah, you'll
my
hear
in-laws
doggies.
Dog. You may hear a bark or two, but yeah. So Boston nickname from being from Boston, but not even from Boston, from a little town outside of Boston.
Called Duxbury.
Or well, Duxbury. Boston's a cooler name than going around being named Duxbury.
Yeah. No, and then you get the wise guys who are like, oh, should I just call you Duxbury? And I was like, good luck to you. That's not going to last long.
I have people, my first name is William, and people always, when they find that out, they're like, well, I'm going to call you Bill now. And I'm like, no, you're not. Like, you say that, but you won't. And I'm always like, sure, like, go ahead. Like, that's fine. Like, everyone who has ever said, I'm going to call you Bill, does not call me Bill. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, there was Andy Turek, who is our key grip on this movie. I think it was either like the check. Oh, yeah. We gave him to fill up a gas. We gave him one of the credit cards from the movie, and it had my first name on it. And so he was like, should I call you Boston or should I call you Scott? And he called me Scott a couple times. And it kind of just like it takes my brain, because it's been so long, it takes my brain a little bit to recognize. And I just don't respond to someone I'm not familiar with calling me Scott. If it's my family, absolutely. Like, I'll just listen. But it's like, I kind of ignore when someone says, hey, Scott, you know, I'm like, they're not talking to me. Yeah.
It's really fun spending the holidays with his family and everyone's like, hey, Scotty. And I'm like, hey, Boston. But fun fact, my first name, I also have a nickname. My first name is Lauren.
Yeah.
And my parents just gave me a nickname from day one. So it's like they took the run out of Lauren. Mm-hmm. And created Rennie.
I actually do find that interesting that the two of you have, because I wondered about that too. I was like, Rennie seems like something that's
a made up name for
short
sure.
for something else, or like your full name is Renegade or something like that.
That's her full nickname.
That was my nickname
in middle school.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty badass.
Yeah, well, Rennie Grahams almost sounds like Renegade.
Renegade.
And then she also has a sister too, named Allison, who goes by Sunny. You know, so it's like,
yeah,
I think it's a little bit of a pattern.
Yeah,
yeah, okay, okay.
It's actually it's like in even in I think they might have adopted this from Japanese like naming conventions, but in Japan, lot of times they take just one syllable and turn it into a nickname. So that kind of was like the,
I've never thought
of
that.
I think a similar pattern.
So this is interesting to me. So you're two LDS people from the East Coast who moved to Utah. You don't meet in school, but you both have names that are nicknames that were given to you. You both have huge ties to Japan. Like your family, like did missions in Japan partially raised you in Japan. And Boston, yeah. You went to Japan on your mission? Is that right?
Yeah, I went to an immersion school in elementary school, Virginia. And it was like, yeah, so it makes no sense. And I was exposed to it. I'll be honest. I think immersion programs don't work very well because I definitely was not fluent, going to school. I think you just sort of guess like, oh, math, I get it. I'm looking at the numbers. They make sense. Don't know what my teacher just said, but I can figure this out. I did this immersion school. But because I had studied it, I studied Spanish in middle school and high school when I moved to Massachusetts. And I was like, by college, I was like, I really should just get back into Japanese. And so I studied Japanese at college, ended up getting going and serving an LDS mission in Japan, which is another can of worms that we don't have to go into. But yeah. And then I came back and finished a minor in Japanese. So I still speak it, which is just interesting. But it definitely here's what's fun. Like, right. So the guy I worked under in Japan as a Mormon missionary, he continued doing more Mormon stuff and became a lot bigger in the church. And so he was in Japan when Rennie's parents were in Japan and they were both working in the office. Now he was like the president, right? Like the president of this office in Japan for the church. And they were like under his, direction, taking this, that, and the other thing. So Rennie and I start dating and I happen to be at like this reunion and he's there and I take Rennie there as a date, and we've been dating for a month. And
I had met him the year before, visiting my parents in Japan. And my parents would do funny things like make me sing at meetings. And so I've like sung for these leaders of the church in Japan. And he comes up to me and I was like, he shakes my hand. And I was like, hi, I think you know my parents, Conan and Cindy Grahams. And he gave me one of those like handshakes that lasted for like 60 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he was like, we need to take a picture. And the next thing I know, a picture is being emailed to my parents and I get a phone call from my dad. And he's like, who are you dating now? Yeah. That's how my dad met my now husband.
No, it was great. It was like the best way, because if you think about it, here I am, just a guy dating this hot girl. And like, I'm like, oh, I got to meet her parents at some point, but her parents are overseas. How is this going to happen? Naturally, I get a recommendation from their boss. And he's like, oh, yeah, I really like this guy. And he's dating your daughter now. And it's like, great. So, their boss is like, yeah, 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 this guy's good. You got a good guy already. I got a great
instant approval.
Yeah, it was perfect. It was like, if you're applying for a job, you got to know somebody who works there. And so here I was applying for this relationship and, I knew the president of the company. And so it all worked out.
That's amazing. I just find it fascinating, the amount of overlap between your stories. Like really fascinating to me, like in just these weird ways that like you're both blonde too. Like
I'm a bottle blonde, so that doesn't count.
Okay, all right. So you're just trying to like keep the family looking like very pure and Aryan.
I'm one of those, like, I was blonde when I was little, and then
But our eyes are blue, so there you go.
Wow, cool.
Yeah,
all right,
we both have blue eyes. It works.
We're both 5'7". All
right. So that's
really 5'6".
Are you both to the same height?
Yeah.
Wow, that's wild too. That's a really specific height too, 5'7". That's a really specific.
It's actually 5'6½", but we just say 5'7".
Okay, your mohawk helps you bump it up to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, when I wear heels, he spikes his mohawk a little higher,
just to compensate.
Oh, that's great.
All the men in my family, like they are like the exact same height. It's just like boom, like 5'6". And we always have this dream that one of our kids will inherit some kind of genetic anomaly of height or whatever, and just pop up to 5'8" or 5'9", and just it's not happening. It has not
that
happened.
They'll reach the heights of 5'8" or 5'9". All the men in my family are about the same height too. My dad and my two brothers are about 5'9", and then your boy is 5'11". So,
ooh.
And I'm the youngest. So yeah. Like, I'm always in photos like, yeah, that's right, guys. Like, if in the family basketball team, I'm the center. And yeah. I'm the one who's swatting you fools at the rim.
That's amazing.
Which is why you have a fantastic modeling career.
exactly. Right? It's the mustache and the height. They yeah. can't, you know, deny it.
It's not your fault that you were born with a perfect bone structure.
I can't help it. I can't, like, it all went to me. The other people got parts of it, not but then fault. I got it all. So, so anyway, okay, so... you meet on a movie set. This is a big part of your story, is making movies together, and a big part of what you love doing. I also find it interesting, Rennie, and I want to talk about this in a bit, the idea of like making the switch full time to film from theater. Because as a person who does both, I'm always I wonder about putting more energy into one or the other and like what that does for a career. But I do want to talk, I want to get us into Alien Country Land, because a big part of what I want to talk to you about today is like, I don't think people fully understand what a absolutely insane, massive undertaking putting a movie together is. It is such a, especially people like in the theater world or people, you know, it's like, it's hard to talk to a theater like, and say, I have an idea for a play.
Didn't I know what a terribly overly incredibly laborious task
ambitious
this was gonna be.
Insane
it's insane, it's crazy, and it's like this almost all the time. It's like this with studio films. It's like years of pre-production, you know, about a year of like getting into principal photography and finishing it, and then like a year or two of editing and distribution. Like it's such a massive undertaking every single time. And then getting all the money together and making sure that everyone's schedules work out. And that it's like, so when does the seed of Alien Country begin? And let's kind of start getting into this story of putting this
together. Well, the first time we read a scene from Alien Country, it was a very, very different script and idea and concept back then, was when we were dating, probably almost 8 or 9 years ago. And we were in some, I think we were in a library somewhere, and we got a group of people together to do a table read. And I don't know, it was maybe 15 pages or something. It was
I have almost no memory of this.
I have very little memory of it, but I do remember this moment of sitting around the table and everyone just laughing and thinking it was so funny. And at that moment, I just kind of felt like there was something really special happening. And then it morphed into a script called Shotgun Jimmy, which we were focusing, really Boston was focusing mainly on it about 5 years ago when we were first married, almost 6 years ago now. And we were breaking it down. We're like, oh, we want to raise $1 million for this movie. And then gave up on that and then revised the script a lot more after that and decided to go low budget.
The first version of this script, and I actually happened to probably a couple months before we began shooting, I stumbled upon where I had kept all the revisions and all these versions. And so I made a short film. There were two of them. There was, the first one was called Double Barrel Americana. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that seemed like a good title. But it was just a short film about this character who was in a band, and her boyfriend was using the van that they would tour in their band with to go and rob banks while they went town to town. And that was, it was just kind of a funny story. And so she was dating this guy, and then she ended up the movie, this was supposed to be like a prequel to the movie. And then the movie starts where she's dating that guy's half brother. And the joke was that there were seven brothers in this town who were all children of the same guy, you know, and he just kind of, but he had seven different mistresses or something like that. Right. So it's interesting. There's a Sting song from one of his random solo albums called 10 Summoner's Tales, where there's this song about, I think it's called Love is Stronger Than Justice, or Love is, I don't know, anyway, really great chorus. But the song starts off where he goes, this is the story of seven brothers who had the same father but different mothers, who stick together like a family should, roaming the country for the common good. Anyway, so it's this silly idea. And I realized that as a kid, there was a seed of that implanted in my brain. And then when I was writing this story, I happened to listen to that song super randomly, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's where that idea came from, was some Sting song I listened to as a kid. But anyway, so we rewrote that short film into Shotgun Jimmy. And then I had this really cool opportunity. I interviewed Stan Lee randomly at some comic convention. And he was, I was asking him, what's an advice you have for, you know, writers out there? And he's like, I always give the same advice. Don't write for other people. He's like, I would always write to please myself. So I'd try to think of what kind of story I'd enjoy reading. And that's what I'd create. And of course I created Spider-Man, you know? And like,
it's a very good then, Stan Lee.
Yeah. Thank you. So that was really, really cool. And that there was a night where literally I had written this whole thing out, and it was probably like the second or third draft of this script. And I was like, you know what this script is really missing that I would love is aliens. And you know, we were actually, I was shooting the short film with a friend, and I was out in the middle of the desert, at this gas station. And I talked to this lady, and this around the same time. And she was just, and I was like, just, she was a gas station attendant, you know, older lady. And in the middle of nowhere. And I was like, you ever see anything weird out here? And, you know, cause there happened to be this like government, lab, like military testing area from like the, I don't know, 60s, 70s nearby that they call Area 52. And so I was kind of curious about that. And I was like, do you ever see anything weird out here? And she's like, all the time. And she just proceeded to like go off about all these UFOs and all these things she'd seen and like just bizarre stuff. And we're making this little horror short film out there. And so I was like, yep, this movie needs aliens. So I rewrote the movie with aliens in it. And the budget was ridiculous. It was easily $2 to $5 million. We had it budgeted out for like 1.7 and 1.2. And anyway,
that was going to be stretching it.
Yeah, right.
For sure.
And there was a lab. It was basically season one of Stranger Things condensed into 90 minutes. And you know, but I wrote something that I would enjoy. And it wasn't until like, you know, 3 or 4 years later that I was like, let's really make this movie, but make it something that's relatively doable for us. And so we basically pared it down. And, you know, we got it in the can for a lot less than $1 million. But it still was a kind of a crazy stretch. But along these lines too, it was called Shotgun Jimmy, and it was really just about the main character, Jimmy. And at a certain point, I really wanted it to be about this relationship between Everly and Jimmy, the two, you know, leads. And the idea too was like, at that point in my life, you know, I'd been in a relationship for longer, and I got tired of all of these stories of falling in love. And it's like every meet cute, you know, like, but I was like, what's a meet cute? What's the formula for a movie about a couple that's been together for, you know, over a decade? And that's what this movie is. It's about a couple that grew up together, you know, dated since high school, but has never committed actually being in a long-term, getting married or being in a long-term relationship. You know, maybe they've been in and out of a relationship. And so the meet cute for them already in a relationship was accidentally being forced into the next stage of life, which is having a kid. So she gets the meet cute in Alien Country is that she gets pregnant. And then we retitled it to Alien Country because
accidentally gets pregnant.
Yeah, she accidentally gets pregnant, you know, and that forces them to figure out what's important in their relationship. And ultimately, they discover that they care about each other so deeply that they're willing to do anything, you know, to save their relationship, their town, the galaxy, what have you. So
now, yeah. In terms of just practicality and getting something made, it's amazing to me, and I think this happens all the time, especially with independent film, how much of your writing decisions, and it sounds like you were really able to motivate and justify everything that you were doing and changing based on stuff that worked for you emotionally and that worked for you story-wise. But it's also like it comes down to just
budget.
Yep, just comes down to numbers and figures where you're like, we've got to figure out a way to recraft this story that where we could shoot it for $250,000, $300,000, something like that. Which it's like when you think about major things that people are doing, people who don't do what we do, people who aren't like trying to start a business, you know, like trying to like, I want to open a cafe and I'm looking for a loan to get this space that I want, like massive things. Like I need to have enough money to like get a little bit of a staff going and like get all of my equipment. It's like they're maybe trying to raise like 50, 60 grand to like get the initial down payment on the space and just kind of secure like enough time to get off the ground and get things going. It's like, it's crazy that even when you were saying a movie that costs $2 to $5 million in the Hollywood realm, $2 to $5 million is a low budget, is a super low budget movie. And it's just insane. It's almost, impossibly insane, the task of approaching funding a film and going like, we're trying to get $1 million and that's small. And then you go, I don't know if we're going to get $1 million. Let's see if we can rework it to a script that we can do for $500,000. And that's like so small, which is, to me, it just seems it's too big. It's so big to the point where I don't even know if I want to begin the task. You know what I mean? How do you get the ball rolling on something like that?
Oh my gosh, my brain's spinning on this question.
Yeah.
So I feel like one of the keys to getting the ball rolling is to just talking about the project, first of all. And then we would get really great feedback about the project and about the script. And that would give us momentum to get to the next step. But one of the things that I feel like Boston and I kind of like excel at, and this is something we talk about in, I don't know if you know this, but we actually have a little side hustle called Indie Film School, where we're actually talking about how we make our stuff as we're making it. And
that's
so
right. Yeah.
That's something that we want to funnel into Indie Film School, is talking about this film and how we made it, which is, you know, we work for clients, you know, as well. And we've done YouTube videos, and oftentimes we would be given a budget. They'd be like, you have $60,000. You have $20,000. Go make X. And we have to put the puzzle together and like move around all the pieces to go get a product that a client is happy with. And I feel like that's sort of what we decided to do with this movie, is like, we know that if we make a movie for $500,000, you know, in and out of the, you know, like we did production for less than that, but you know, we can make a return based on these numbers that we've done research on, blah, blah, blah. And then we just like created a puzzle for ourselves, the biggest puzzle on the planet, which is an ever shifting, ever moving puzzle. Honestly, like even now, as we're wrapping up the movie and we're like paying our invoices and we're cutting our checks, like we're moving money around from different departments that spent less here and spent more there or whatever. So I feel like that's sort of just like, we're given a limitation and we have to be crazy creative within those limitations. And I'm going to give you an amazing example that we dealt with just last week. Like, this movie is car heavy, right? Like, we had so many cars in this movie. We had derby cars. We had trucks that had to be very specific. We had an Everly's car. We had police cars, two different types of police cars. We had one that was modern, one that was old. And we really wanted a police car down in Southern Utah that's like 4 hours away. And these police cars can't drive them themselves. They have to be hauled, you know?
Right.
And if you call up a company that does this for real, they charge like $3,000. And we literally did not have $3,000 to haul two vehicles down to, you know, like basically $6,000 to haul two vehicles down to Tickaboo. So we literally spent, you know, 2 weeks between several different producers trying to figure out how to get these vehicles down. And I will tell you, we did both of those vehicles. We got both of them down there for less than $1,000. You know, it's just like this puzzle that you have to continually put together and figure out. And if you get creative and make phone calls and ask favors and say, hey, come make a movie with us, we'll put you up, we'll feed you food, people come out of the woodworks and have an amazing time.
Yeah. And you don't want that to be an abusive thing either,
no.
Right? Like, where if that's not your thing, or it's like, oh, I've done this before, I'm not interested. Okay. Next person, somebody might be interested in this. This might be a cool opportunity for the right person. So you're going to run into hiring other people who are veterans who've like had the experience, or people who it's like, this is an opportunity for them to get into something that they haven't done yet. And so we definitely, you know, and also we had to be realistic with our expectations, where it's like, oh, well, in my head, I want it to be this crazy cool thing, but the limitation of we only have one day to do this, or half a day to do this, or all of that were the things that's what, like, when you have that $1 million or $2 to $5 million, whatever, when you have that, you're like, oh, okay, no, I can spend an entire day on this one scene that has so much action and, you know, a dramatic moment or whatever. I can spend all the time necessary to make that the best. But on the budget we have, it's like, no, you've got 3 hours and you've got to fill the rest of the 9 hours in your day with three other scenes. And so that was something you have to be practical about and say, all right, considering that, I've got to really dial in and figure out exactly what I need for these moments. but at the same time be okay when it's not perfect or what I want it to be.
Yeah, I definitely noticed as an actor really quick, like from like day one, that I was like, oh, we're moving fast. Like, we got to move fast. But it also just made me go, okay, cool. So like, I got to like try to have a good idea of what I want to do and try to get a good couple rehearsals out and then just be ready to go because we're cruising.
We're not taking time to like do 10 takes. Right.
Try it a different way or you know, and stuff like that. But it's kind of fun when it's like that too, because then like for the most part, you as a director, Boston, are just sort of like, like trusting that you cast it well enough that you're like
that, which we totally did.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We've talked about this so many times. I have two thoughts in my brain, and one is I'm going to back up a little bit. One is that like we encountered so many people who are veterans in the film industry here who were so excited about our this project specifically. I think partly because we're so passionate about it, and it's just fun and it's different and it's funny that we were able to bring on people who were also just excited to work on the project, even if the pay wasn't as much as they were as used to, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So, but, and then fast forwarding, like we have talked so many times between ourselves, how extremely lucky we were with the cast that came to the table and that we ultimately cast to bring to the table, because everyone just nailed it. Everyone just like got onto set. And
I'm just kidding.
The guy who played Bo.
With the exception.
Right. I wasn't going to say it, but you know, anyway, address the elephant in the room here.
It's all right. We're here. We're like principal photography is done. Like, what are you going to do? Are you going to recast my part? I don't think so. So you're stuck with it now. And you're
Austin
paid.
He did his callback in a car.
Yeah.
And we were like, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, just so you know, Austin read for multiple characters, Bo, Gus. He also read for Jimmy. Like, I felt actually on that spectrum, just the reality and the comedic sensibilities, as well as realism that you brought to your auditions and all that sort of stuff. I was happy to like trust you with almost any character in the film, to be honest, with the exception of maybe Nana, who needed to be an older retired woman. But then again, you know, you probably could pull it off. So no, I felt really good about the casting overall. Was just absolutely, I don't know if we got lucky or we just worked with Jeff Johnson Casting here in Salt Lake, and they just brought the right people to the table, and people came out of the woodwork, and just like, even our sheriff, I was so excited to work with Sila Gavale, who's like a guy, you know, I had never heard of. He's a local, and he just like blew it out of the water with this just gristled, you know, sheriff character.
Good is Sila? Sila's so good, dude. Yeah. And he's so different on screen from who he is off screen. Like, the camera starts rolling and he's this like really tight, like soft, like, yeah, like got this like little growl. And then off camera, he's like, oh, how's it going? Like, huh? Like he's like,
and he just laughs.
He
giggly laughs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I was like, I thought when we cast him, I was like, oh, he's going to be like this, like, you know, kind of presence of like, I don't know what I was thinking. Like, he's this like strong, you know, gristled actor who's just going to like walk on set and I'm going to have to be more professional and like talk to him in a certain, you know, way. And like, and then I like walk up to him. He's like, hey, man. And I'm just like, oh, he's super down to earth.
Yeah, he's just a sweetie. He's just like this really like sweet guy who's like really smiley and like and nice and tender.
And ultimately, though, that was a thing I really struggled with in a weird way as a director, is I felt like, thank goodness the actors could just deliver brilliant performances. But it also is this moment where I was like, well, that's something I really would have loved to have more time to work on. That's what I wanted to do, is go through these scenes with them and find more to them, find more jokes.
Rehearse and find more nuances.
And I even felt like I gave more direction during the casting process, during like callbacks and this, that, than I actually gave on set. Because once we were cast, we're like, okay, here's the scene, go with it. And it's not necessarily true, because there were even some scenes where we had to do some rewrites in the moment or change things in the moment. But as far as like finding, you know, more, you know, more pivot, I call them a lot of times pivots in a scene, where a line all of a sudden cues an emotional change. and finding more pivots and finding more things that characters can like play off each other. Like, we just frankly didn't have the time on our budget level to do that. And so it was wonderful being able,
I think that's why I got thrown a little bit that one night that Charla and I did that scene in the office, because it was the first time that we actually had time to like really delve into something. And so you were like trying all this different stuff with me. And I was like, I'm getting notes for the first time in the entire movie. And then I was like, I'm bad. I'm doing a bad job. But then I realized, like, as I was driving home, I was like, I think it's just that, like, we had time for it. Yeah. So he was just like, well, we might as well, like, like get in here and like get our, you know. But it's so funny. Actors are so insecure that it's like the second I'm supposed to get notes, like I'm supposed to be doing adjustments. And we had been moving so quick on the movie that, like, the first time I got notes, I was like, oh no, I'm fired. I'm out of the movie.
Well, that was the brilliance of, like, we had this location that, you know, we had to be out of, and then we went down the street and we only had like a page and a half. I don't know how long that scene was, but we still had 6 hours. So we like nailed like three and a half pages or four pages.
They like dialed in this lighting that looks so insanely cool. And then they had, you guys had the time, but like, that's one of the audition scenes that people auditioned for, which really, like, as I was watching the auditions, was hard for people to nail, because it's an emotional scene, but there's this like shock factor that you're experiencing, your character experiences. And it was interesting to watch, like, you nailed it. It's a difficult scene. Like, it's this, you know, you've just come from seeing your brother die. And so it's like, you could have gone super emotional with it, or we could have gone like angry. We could have gone, but like, there's this balance of like shock and not believing what you're seeing, but like processing your brother's death. And anyway, it was brilliant.
I think it'll probably wind up being the scene that I use in my reel. Like that, like that'll be the thing that, you know, so yeah, it'll probably wind up being like one of my favorites, but I think it's
let alone all the scenes of you running. Yeah,
there's going to be a separate reel of me running in this movie. Just running. There's going to be a separate thing where I let people know, like, I can run. Check it out. Like, this is my screen.
You are so entertaining as an actor. You could just run, and the entire crew and cast would watch you during your take. Sorry, I'm spiking.
Oh man.
And we would just like, we would all be giggling silently until Boston would yell cut, and we
great.
I remember someone said, like, is that how he runs for real? Like, is
that does he actually run that way?
Yeah.
I was like, man. No, I'm supposed to be exhausted. And
we did this, which
we actually were.
Yeah, we were filming in this canyon, and it was basically a chase sequence, which is so funny. There's I really want to make a chase sequence that's more true to life, because after you've run like, I don't know, a quarter mile, you're just like, oh man, like you're dogging it. You know? But these like when you cut a chase sequence, there's enough time to like rest that you can do another quick sprint. But even then it's exhausting. And when you cut it all together, it looks like these people were sprinting for miles, you know, and that's great. It's cool. It'll make it exciting. But it's really funny that on this day, we did one where like we had a drone basically chase for a bit the three heroes through this canyon. And on one of the takes, I looked and I could just see, like, first of all, Charon Prabhakar, who played our character Ben, he had to like do this stunt where he tripped. And so he tripped and tripped and tripped and probably did like 6 or 7 takes of that. And then he had to do these, you know, chasing with the drone runs. And on like the third take, I could just tell he was just like beat. And so he's like running and his arms are flailing. And I was like, oh, well, all right, that's the take. But it's, you know,
it's gnarly to do like a dead sprint, like 5 times in a row. Yeah.
In the middle of the day, in the desert, in the heat with like, you know, all these random like I had boots and tight jeans on and you know, so not the most convenient wardrobe and all that stuff, and we were running in sand for part of it.
I heard that for a lot of James Bond films they make all these suits for him, and there's different versions of different ones where it's like this is his fighting suit set, and they put all these like spandex things like in all the like the armpits and the knees. So it's like all these things. So the suit still looks relatively the same, but if you looked up close, you'd be like, no, this is just designed so that he can fight or he can run or whatever.
Again, budget. We've got it in the budget that we've got 9 different kinds of suits that he wears for different scenarios, and he will change between them throughout the shooting day.
On our film, you know, we provided you with your own wardrobe. So there you go. Whatever you brought to set, it was like, do you guys need my shoes? Because these are my personal shoes that I wear. I was like, nope, I guess you're taking them home.
that's good. You can have those. You can actually have those back. Oh, thank you. you talked a little bit about, though, when you're making something, you guys have this indie film school where you're teaching people how to do this massive undertaking, this massive mammoth thing that seems so impossible. You talked a lot about sort of this concept of just like asking around. Like, you go to your first place and they say, we can get you that car down to Southern Utah for $3,000, and we can get 2 down for $6,000. And it's like, well, let's not accept the first offer. I think that's a big part of making stuff for small. I always tell people, on a much smaller scale, I produce and direct my own music videos. It's kind of a nice way for me to like practice the process of like having a concept, storyboarding it out, like making a shot list, working with a DP, and like getting the thing done. It's easy. We don't need sound. You know, like there's a lot of like, but like, I always tell people when they watch them, because people are like, where, how'd you get that location? Or like, how'd they allow you to shoot there? And it's like, just asking, to be honest. Like, I'll have an idea of where I want to shoot, and then I just go to places and ask them what their rate would be for us to shoot for a day. And I ask till I get the price that I want. And like, I usually am doing these things on a budget of like $300 for the whole thing. And so I need to find people who are willing to come and work with me for free for a day. But it's also about like being economical with their time and understand, like Boston, you mentioned, like making sure that it's not an abusive thing and making sure that I'm not like taking advantage of people, making sure that people are excited about it, that like they want to participate, that I'm being mindful of the time that they're donating, that I'm, you know, not going like, cool, awesome, I'm so glad that you guys are in. It's going to be a 2-week long shoot in 10 locations. It's like, nowadays, no, it's a 3-minute music video. Like, if we can find a single location with a small cast and crew, and find a place, usually in Salt Lake, there's locations that will let you come in for free and just will be like, as long as it's not in business hours, you can come in and maybe like we'll have an employee there that you might want to like tip $50 and, you know, and that's it. But you can't really do that in LA. LA's too much of a film savvy town. Like any place that you ask, like, can we shoot here? They're like, well, yeah, for $5,000.
$5,000 a day. Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah, but
and they always ask it, and there are places too. I mean, we tried to turn down a location. The exact price. It was like they wanted $3,000 for the location, and then $2,000 to pay someone to be there. And I was like, we don't have $2,000 day rates for anyone.
Right.
So like, that's just not going to happen. Is that negotiable? And they're like, no, absolutely not. And we're like, oh, okay, well then I guess what we'll do is find a completely different location.
You know, really, like the week before we started shooting, we still didn't have. We call it the. In the script, it was the gas station location, and we basically just turned it into a garage for budget reasons. And I think it was the week before we started shooting, we found that location last minute, and it just ended up being that you were at the garage location, right? Mm-hmm. Where you guys ride up in your motorcycles.
Yeah.
We were trying to get an actual gas station that had a garage attached to it that was not branded. There's a beautiful one, you know, up the canyon here in Utah that a lot of movies shoot at. And because of that, they wanted a certain price and we couldn't pay it. So we changed, you know? So
wouldn't that be funny if we had a set for a day where the highest paid person on set is just the attendant who's sitting in a lawn chair waiting for us to leave.
Sitting on the lawn chair.
Higher than the principal cast, higher than the director of photography, higher than the director, higher than like,
just when they let us know that, we were like, okay, that's all right.
Yeah, funny you say that too. Is like, so Rennie and I didn't, as a producer or director, didn't pay ourselves for this film. In fact, we're like, of course, investors in our own project, which I think is a big thing that. Okay, no more clucking. Come on out. But I think for directors and, you know, or indie filmmakers, like that's the reality is that we, you know, but what's really interesting is halfway through our fundraising process, we started talking to people. And we started telling them that, well, to be honest, the first money we came up with for this project was our own. And they kind of go, oh, why didn't you lead with that? because I think there is this piece where you're bringing a team together. If they see how much you're putting into it, and you know, and I said it a couple times on set, but I didn't want to like boast about it. But it was like people who complained about their paycheck, I would kind of say, look, dude, I am not getting paid to do this. Now, at the same time, I'm, you know, I own the product. So the idea is that in a couple of years, I will start making money back. But it's a huge investment of time, energy, and like even my own cash money up front. I think that's really important for creators to know is like, don't, you're not, if you want to get your art off the table, you can't approach it with this entitlement sense that, oh, I'm going to find an investor and they're going to pay me to make my art. Because I just don't think you're, well, first of all, maybe you will, and maybe that's fine, and maybe you have a good attitude about it, but I think that that breeds a little bit of entitlement, and then that breeds less responsibility. It's really important as an artist to say, I am so responsible. Like, when I put my own money into this project, it has to make that money back, so I am putting my blood, sweat, and tears to make sure that I don't screw this up, that I make this the best thing it possibly can be.
Well, even M. Night Shyamalan said something when he made the movie Split, and he had just come off like The Visit and Split, and it was like a little bit of like, people were like, ooh, is he back? Like, is he back to form? And what he said he did was he kind of had this like come to Jesus heart to heart with his production team, where he was like, I think that we've gotten a little too comfortable taking studio money and just like having everything taken care of for us. Wow. So he said that he put almost all his own money into The Visit, and then mostly his own money into Split. And he also hired a new team of like a new director of photography and like new people that he wanted to like challenge him and push him in new directions. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's how he made his earlier films, was a lot of his own investment. Like, a lot of his own money went into The Sixth Sense, and a lot of his own money went into these earlier projects. And he felt like, if I have, I need to put my skin back in this. I need to make it so that I need this to work in order for me to make my next movie. And I thought that was a really interesting thing that he recognized philosophically, that he's like, maybe I'm just playing it safe because I don't stand to personally lose a whole lot if the movie doesn't do well, you know?
Interesting.
I mean, his reputation, but I guess, you know.
sure. Right.
No, but he can still keep going. I actually heard, all right. Okay. Out.
Sorry.
What's your dog's name?
Rebel and Molly. Molly's my parents' dog. Rebel is. Yeah, I don't understand.
That's funny. There's some weird sounds or something. Okay. Yeah, the other side of it too. Okay.
They're fine.
What are we talking about?
Don't worry about it.
Well, what I was going to say is I heard Reese Witherspoon actually did the same thing when she got, I think it was Big Little Lies off the ground. Mm-hmm. She said that she did what everyone tells you not to do, which is she put her own money into it instead of, because she, it was not getting off the ground. You know, something like that had never been done before. And she talked about reaching a certain age as a woman where she just stopped getting cast and stopped getting offers. And, it could have been Big Little Lies, or I think she did Wild or something, but one of those projects that she started making with her own production company, it took her own skin in the game to get it off the ground, you know? So I mean,
obviously for Reese Witherspoon or for even M. Night Shyamalan or anyone like that, like putting your own money, like putting $1 million of your own money into a project isn't quite as big of a risk as it is for people in a lower tax bracket and people who
people like us who are like, well, right, that was our savings.
Right. You know, that's like all of our money and we're just taking a leap of faith. It's obviously not as big of an investment, but also like, that's just kind of the name of the game with doing stuff like this, is like, how much are you willing to invest in this thing that you say you want to do more than anything else in the world? I sort of agree with the idea of like, are you just expecting that it's going to be funded and bankrolled by other people, like right off the bat? Like, whether it's investing in buying equipment or investing in hiring a team to help you out, like some amount of significant personal investment, I think, is going to be necessary. Even if you're like a painter and it's just about like investing in like higher quality materials and things like that, like some amount of personal investment, I think, is always necessary if you want to take your work to the next level. I want to talk a little bit about what do you think precipitates getting to the point, we kind of went through the process of like the first table read around a table where you've got like a few pages of this thing that then turns into Shotgun Jimmy, that then eventually turns into Alien Country, and the way that that gets molded by budgetary concerns and everything like that. What do you think, is there a thing that happens that makes you go, oh, we're doing this now? We are now heading into like casting, and we have a schedule for principal photography, or like a rough idea, like we've got people on board who are going to make this happen? Or is that all just a process of little things, one after another after another?
Yeah, I think that there's the Ira Glass quote about the gap, right? It was just some interview he was doing, and he randomly said, you know, a lot of people who do creative work go through a period of years where the work they make is a disappointment to them.
Yeah,
I definitely felt like so much of what I had done in the YouTube space or whatever was a great training ground. And we were forcing ourselves to just meet deadlines, produce more content, make more things. I was working for clients. I was working, you know, doing commercials, et cetera, for years. And I just felt like there was never something people go, oh, let me see your work. And I ultimately, the trajectory I wanted to go on is I didn't want to be a commercial director. You know, I wanted to go into narrative. I'd rather direct television. And there's like, how do you get there? And I talked to some people and they were like, oh, you already have your reel. Like you have enough stuff in your reel that could land you the right agent, land you the right this, that. But I talked to a producer who actually is one of a big Disney producer. He'd done a bunch of like, you know, big films like Pirates, you know, the Caribbean. And he was like, well, if you really want to launch in and be, you know, in the top 1% or even in the top 10%, of directors, you know, who are doing narrative, you have to have a calling card. And that was like, it was like, if you don't have that calling card, if you don't have like, oh, have you seen Alien Country? Oh yeah, no, I know Alien Country, blah, blah. Like if I don't have that, then I really am just, I have to basically be the best self-promoter ever. And I'm terrible at self-promotion in that I want my work to speak for itself. And right. I don't like speaking for my work. You got to do both ultimately. But at the end of the day, I think the long answer to your question is that like, for me, I had made all this work and it was kind of a disappointment to me. And I was like, this isn't what I really want it to be. I need to make the thing that sets me out from the rest of the pack.
Yeah.
As a creator. And so after year, we would go to Sundance cause it's local here in Utah, but a big film festival. And I just got tired of sitting in the crowd, watching these people tell their stories. And every year telling myself, well, next year I'm going to be on that stage, or next year I'm going to at least have made my film. And after, you know, 3 or 4 years of sitting there telling myself that and realizing it wasn't true, we decided, no matter what, this year we're making this film and that's it. Like it is, you know, and the script needed to get to a place. I think that took longer than I wanted it to a place where we felt completely confident that we could make a great movie. And that took time, you know, and I wanted it to happen faster, but ultimately it didn't. And we knew that from table reads. I wanted to make this in 2019, but we did a table read and the table read was a disappointment. It wasn't funny. It wasn't there. And I knew that there was something wrong with the story. So we readdressed it, but we basically said, no, hard deadline. We're finishing this film this year, 2020, regardless of what happens. Luckily, there was a global pandemic. Everything shut down.
Luckily, making it, COVID happened.
Making it easier to do everything. No, but, you know, we decided the train was leaving regardless of global pandemic or whatever. And just once you make that decision, you just say, no, I'm doing it. People will constantly tell you, no, stop, don't, dangerous, risk, you can't, no. And just you have to like shut that completely off and say, bro, you don't know. I'm an artist, you know. So
I think the idea of wanting the script to get to a certain place, but it's not happening on the timeline that you want it to happen on. That's one of those aspects of like putting something like this together where it's like it's not just a numbers thing and it's not just a scheduling thing. It's like as a writer, I know the issues with like working with a team of people who want me to have revisions to a script by a certain date. And I'm like, I know in theory what needs to happen to these pages, but actually having it come out in a way that I feel good about and that I feel like sounds good and sounds actable and sounds like it fixes the problems that we have, that's not something you can just force. Like it's such a hard thing to approach a script and know, I know exactly what needs to happen. I know that this scene needs to be 3 pages shorter, and I know that this information needs to come out here instead of here, and I know that this needs like 4 more jokes in it. I know like what, in theory, what needs to happen, but forcing it is just so difficult, and it's like if it doesn't flow out organically, it just feels wrong. Like if you sit down and try to force it out. So sometimes, yeah, script stuff can be tough. And I think, go ahead.
Well, something that we work really well with is deadlines. So we have created over the past year and a half, multiple deadlines and outer accountability that forced us to meet deadlines. And did we always meet the deadline exactly where we needed to? But like, for instance, a year ago this summer, we had a table read in a barn, and we were like, we're making this movie. We're super excited. This is the one that kind of fell flat. It still was super well received, but we literally did an entire rewrite just for that table read. Mm-hmm. And then we did probably 2 or 3 more table reads throughout the year, over the next year, where we would just like, we would set a date and we're like, people are coming over. We're going to do this table read. And some of them were for investors. And there was literally a table read where the day of, we were still like combing through the script and changing things like at 5 o'clock. And we had people coming over at 6 o'clock to read our script. You know what I mean? Which sounds like we've just gotten really good at creating a deadline and forcing ourselves to meet that deadline. And we also worked with a friend of ours named Sergio Paz for 6 months, where he literally helped us restructure the script twice a week for, you know, from January to like June. And that forced us to reanalyze, relook at the script and ultimately like rewrite it as we were moving forward. And I just think that that's part of the game, is like figuring out what drives you and creating those deadlines so that you can kind of force that organic creativity, which makes no sense, but like,
yeah. And on the other side too, is like, you know, there was this is ironic, but George Lucas had a quote where he said, films aren't released, because they talk about a film release, you know, he says films aren't released, they escape. Right. And it's this idea that ultimately you will want to keep, as a perfectionist, keep, you know, readjusting, fine tuning, fixing. And at a certain point you just have to go. And that absolutely happened. I actually just, like, by the time we had rewritten the script so many times, I just didn't even know if the script was funny anymore. You know, like, yeah. And I was at that point where it was like, okay, but I guess this is the script. And there were still things I wanted to do. And I kept telling myself, well, it's good. We have, you know, 6 weeks or 3 weeks before production. I'll still be able to have time. Honestly, by about a month before going into principal photography, there was no time to work on the script. Like, no time. We were on
back-to-back meetings, just like,
yeah, this is the thing you were talking about earlier, but it's like, people don't understand that how massive an undertaking this is. I did not understand it, but only understood probably about 3 weeks before principal photography, where it was like, literally we would get on the phone at 7 a.m. and we would not get off the phone until 10 p.m. And I was just like meeting, phone call, just working out logistics, working out everything. And it was at that point I realized, holy crap, this is huge. Like I have never worked this much, this hard, this long. And it wasn't until literally 48 hours, now 36 hours ago, that ended for me. Like, it was that work until now. And so it was, yeah.
Even yesterday, because we're still wrapping up. We're still, you know, basically like, you know, wrapping up the movie, you know, and will be for a couple of weeks. But even yesterday we were running an errand in the car, and it was like, we need to take a break.
Oh my gosh.
Like we need to slow down and sleep.
I'll share this. This is a story we're telling. Like, but that pace has been so insane for me. You know, that literally Rennie and I were talking, we're having this relationship talk, because I was just really ornery for the last couple of days, because I've been working on making sure that all of our footage is backed up. I run into all these technical glitches with just getting ready for post-production. And I just been like not in a good headspace. And I'm exhausted. I was like horribly exhausted. And we drive to go run a couple errands, pick up some equipment from our house. And our way back, we go to this drive-through car wash. And I literally was getting around the car wash, and you put your car in neutral. And then I drove the car around to go park and get these vacuum, like get the vacuums for the car. And I press on the brake and I just press it hard. And I was pressing the accelerator and I literally almost crashed our car into the side of this thing. And I slam on the brake and I just broke to, and the, and our dog was like sitting next to me and it like slid into the front seat. And I just like, I just put it in park and started bawling because I'm just like, wow, I'm so exhausted that I like am not safe driving. And I like, and I wasn't tired, but I just was not focused. And so Rennie drove after that.
I was like, but it was, why don't you take a break?
I was, but yeah, it was just that level of pushing. And, you know, about 24 hours before that, we returned the lenses that we had rented for the shoot. And that was a big moment for me where it was like, that was the finally like, okay, lenses are done. We're done with principal photography. That that moment was over. And I'm not trying to like say, oh, this was such a hard task, but it really was the big, this is the most intense thing I've ever done in terms of a physical production.
No, it absolutely is yeah. such a hard task. Yeah. Like I watched the two of you do everything on that set from the very start, from before the day started, from before call time till 2 hours after everyone else wrapped. And that was how it was every single day for the two of you, is like meetings before call time begins and meetings for 2 hours after everyone else is done. And also you're on set all day long. It's like the two of you and like Wes, you know, are at everything, you know?
Yeah.
And it is, it's a massive, massive, massive undertaking. So I think it makes absolute sense to have a moment where you get to breathe and it all sort of like comes rushing forward, like everything that you've just been doing. I mean, even people at the top of their game, this is why people who are doing this at the highest levels, they only release a movie like every 2 or 3 years because it's a lot of work to put something together. It's even crazy when people set that pace. You're like, that's kind of nuts that but they have so many more tools available where it's like a lot of things are already taken care of when they start, you know, if a director gets signed onto a project that like the screenplay already exists for and they've already got like moving pieces and things like that, you know, versus this
someday
where it's like,
that'll be the case for us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's a crazy undertaking. And I definitely relate to the idea of reworking and reworking something to the point where you're like, I don't even know if this is funny anymore. I don't know if it's, but like, this is what we're doing. And this is, you know,
the silver lining on that is like, there was a moment. So I was a post-production intern on this movie, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which is at Sony Pictures Animation. Mm-hmm. And Chris Miller, Phil Lord, let me drop their names. but they were directing it. And this is before they did any of their, you know, 21 Jump Street, Solo, all that stuff. So this is like their first studio film. And I come in, and it was probably like day 2 or 3 of my internship. And I watched the movie that they made and I take off my headphones and they're in the room and I'm like, dude, this movie is hilarious. And they look at each other and they're like, oh, okay. I guess it is. We don't know anymore. We've been on it for 4 years, you know? And it was just like,
yeah.
I was like, this is so good. And they were like, thank you for saying that. Cause yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, there got, even with the album I just put out, there got to be a point where we would do revisions on songs that my guy would send back to me, that Chris would send back to me, and he'd be like, what do you think about this? Or he'd get a new tool and he'd be like, I just got a new like tape delay that I tried putting on this song. What do you think about this? Do you want to try putting this on the other songs on the record? And I'd be like, I don't even know, man. Like, I don't know. I don't know if this is better. Like, I don't know if, like, this is different. It's different than the other thing. And I like it, but I don't know if it's better. I don't know if it's like,
right.
Oh, that's what we needed. It's just kind of like, I don't know, man. I've heard 40 different versions of this song.
Sure.
And I think whatever, like, I think we've got a few different versions that work and we just need to pick one and just, your quote about that George Lucas said films aren't finished, they escape. I think there's a Da Vinci quote that says something like, art isn't finished, it's abandoned. And which means you just walk away from it at a certain point and go, fine, that's the last thing I'm doing with that.
That's it.
I don't know if it's finished, but I abandon it. I walk away and I let someone else own it now, you know?
Yeah, what I think is interesting too is that like in certain moments, especially on this set, that we were all there and if you're the leader, like in whatever department or, you know, in like directing capacity for me, a lot of times I just had to make a decision, but I also have to make that decision with almost this air of like, this is how I want it, even if it isn't how I want it, but it will give people around me the confidence to believe that I know what I'm doing.
How you want it.
And it's like, yeah, so I don't really know. There's probably a better way to do this, but how much time do we have? Okay, perfect. And it was kind of a frustrating thing because a lot of times I would use the same like adjectives to describe like, oh, fantastic. Or I kept saying fantastic or like, oh, wonderful. Yeah, that was spectacular. And they're like, you said that about the last five takes. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But it's like you kind of have to give the people around you the confidence that you're making the right decision, even if you're not confident in that decision, you know?
Well, there's a quote from, I think it might be Uta Hagen or it might be some other famous theater director or someone theater directing aficionado who says that when the actors ask you about a thing in a scene and you're standing, you know, in the audience watching the scene, you should say, yes, I know what to do. And between the time that you get up from your chair and walk to them, you need to make up your mind about what you're going to say. And you just need to say something. Because then that's it. Is like, you just need to have an answer. You can't say like, I don't really know. I don't know. You need to act like you know. You need to pretend. Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of directors wind up doing is, you know, when the DP says, what do you think about this lens versus this lens? And he shows you it and you just go, yeah, definitely, for sure. That's awesome. I love that. But it's like, I actually don't know which one I like more. Maybe sometimes you do. Sometimes you're like, actually, this one feels more right for what we're doing. But sometimes you just got that clicking, ticking clock in your head and you're just like, yep, that's great. Love it. Let's go. Let's get it.
Let's go.
You know, yeah. I can make that work in post. I can definitely cut that together in a way that will work. But yeah, it's just about like having an answer so that everyone feels like someone's steering the ship.
Which is interesting too, because a lot of it's emotion. A lot of it's, you know, I was watching, I was cutting a little scene yesterday together, and there was two different takes, you know, of our lead actor and he delivers the second line pretty much the exact same, but there's this first line and it's like two different reads on this first line. And I sat there bouncing between the two of them for like a few minutes. And then at a certain point I was like, I like the first one better. And again, neither of them, like both of them have something different to say. And so that's what's fun is like every step in the process, there'll be more opportunities, whether it's editing, whether it's on set, whether it's even pre-production or even during the script phase, like, you know, you can make choices. And it will keep evolving as long as you have a general direction for where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And this is something I actually learned during that same internship is that every step will be an opportunity to push your art the direction you want it to go. And so for me in this movie, I want it to be funnier. Like I want every step of the process for a chance to find the joke. And on set, I used to say that, let's find a joke here. There's a joke here. Let's find another joke. Because there will constantly be another opportunity to make another joke. And this is a comedy, you know, hands down. And so obviously there's moments where I want it to be more terrifying and I'll focus in that direction when necessary. But overall, I wanted to find more opportunities. And so if it's daunting to say, is it better? Is it good enough? Is it going to get there? Like if I just remind myself, what's my job? I want the audience to laugh. Okay. Which one of these things will push us in that direction? It kind of gives you a little bit of a guideline or a litmus test to kind of say, okay, yeah, this is working better because it's funnier. Now, it just so happens the thing I was editing yesterday wasn't about a joke. It was more about a character, you know, development. And I went with this take where the actor pauses because and it seems like he's almost a little unsure of how he's answering this question. And that worked for me. It wasn't funny, you know, but I think those decisions, you just have to like, yeah. And on a time crunch or on budget, you don't have a lot of time to make those decisions. When you do, it's great. Again, this goes back to what we were saying with your scene. When we had time, we gave you notes. It was like, wait, am I doing all right? Without that time, you know, with the extra time, you know, maybe it is just a moment to be able to think about it from other angles. And I think it's going to be nice now that we're finally done with principal photography, that we have that time to look at the story in terms of like, what are all the possible other iterations of this story as we go into post.
Yeah. I want to talk about one last thing with the two of you, and then I'll let you go. But basically, I just want to talk really quick about, you mentioned it a little bit. You said, like, we were in the car and we were having a relationship chat because we've been working really hard and we're doing stuff like this. What's that like for you? You've done this before. This isn't your first time, like, working together since you've been dating. It seems like this is a big part of your relationship you're kind of business partners, and like you kind of do everything in your careers together. What is that like for your relationship, and is it easy for you to do that, or does it take a toll that then it bleeds into relationship land? And I mean, to your comfort level, you can answer that question, but
let me just jump off here to say it's super easy. We're perfect at it, and we've never had any problems. So I don't know why everyone thinks it's a big deal.
I don't know why everyone thinks it's so hard.
All right, no, really.
Well, first of all, we've been doing it since we met. So we met on set. We started a YouTube channel together, and there's been a lot of learning and growing along the way. We've literally spent, like, for instance, Valentine's Day 1 year, we flew an airplane together so that we could for a commercial that we were making. And it was like, we need to fly airplanes for this commercial, so this is our date. And then there's all right. moments where, yeah, it was, which worked out, and it was totally
fine. It's not bad. It's not a bad date.
Right. But then, like, there's moments where we've had to learn how to create boundaries and say, we need to stop working. Like, we need to stop talking about work. We need to stop working past this time. We need to force ourselves to just sit and watch TV or go on a date or, yeah. So,
yeah. Unplugging is, actually, unplugging and being present are things that I think I generally struggle with. You know, when I have a project that's a passion project, I'm thinking about it all the time. You know, I'm consumed by it a lot. And I mean, especially this film, I was possessed to a level I haven't been with other things. So it's like 4 a.m. I'm awake. My brain's awake. I'm thinking about the setups for the next day, you know, while we're shooting. And that just was like happening. Like, I could not sleep. And I would just lie in bed and think about, you know, the setups, and then it translated into having nightmares about it, which was great. But I would have these hilarious nightmares where I would be like, I would know where I am. Like, I'd be in a hotel room, and then the crew would come into the hotel room, and they're like, "Well, we have to film the hotel room scene." And I'm like, "There's no hotel. I don't remember where that. Oh wait, no, I remember what that is." And I have to like fake like I remember the scene, and I don't remember it. And anyway, stupid things. But at the same time, with that level of possession or obsession with a project, that can bleed over into your relationship. And I think the thing that's been so great for us is we have a mutually beneficial goal. Rennie, you know, is a beautiful, brilliant actress. And this, we wanted to make a movie that was played to all of her strengths. You know, she's tough. She's, you know, sassy. She has all these like things going for her. And so we created this character that, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be a daunting and tough process. But if maybe for her, she can feel like, yeah, but the product that's getting out of this is going to be so great for me as an actress, because I have an opportunity to be what I've always dreamed of being in a film. And then for me, same type of thing, like, oh, well, at the end of the day, this is a movie that I love. I'm just obsessed with. I love monster movies. I love this. Like, so that helps us push through what is hard. If you're not invested, like I see people trying to make movies, and they make movies that, like, it's like, well, there's a great, you know, market for romance right now, so I'm going to make a romantic movie and sell it to whatever distributor. And I'm like, but you don't like romance movies. Do you watch romance movies? Like, and they, if that isn't their passion, then I see it saying like, well, that's going to cause problems for you in all of your relationships, maybe, and maybe not. But if it was me in their shoes, I think if I wasn't passionate about the product, then I wouldn't have this drive and I wouldn't have this happiness. And if I was upset with my, you know, with my significant other in that situation, it would be, I don't know, game changing. It would be dark, because if I don't love what I'm doing already, and then I have an additional problem in my relationship, like, yeah, that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. I feel like I see that a lot in the film industry. I meet people a lot who are telling me about, like, they have a production company that just wrapped a horror movie or something, where they're like, we're just trying to make movies in different genres to see if we can, sell this or that. And I'm like, well, I hope that you still like the stuff that you're making, because that, for me, that's always a thing where I'm like, I can't just like sit down to write a genre script because I think I can sell it. For me to sit down and take the time to write a script, I need to give a shit about it. But that's just me. Yeah.
I think the completion of this thought too is that like, you can, if what you're doing is a disappointment to you, but you love it, it's still okay. Yeah. If what you do is, you know, is, I guess it's like something that you love, when other problems arise in your life, you can still have that as a guiding star. Like, oh, well, we love Alien Country. We love this movie. So I know things are tough right now, but we're doing what we love. And that's so fulfilling. Again, the other side though is out of necessity, you know, I also think working for clients or working for this it's something that you can find reasons why you love it. Yeah. You know, oh, this is such a cool opportunity to work with this new piece of technology, or this is such a cool opportunity for me to hone my skill set in this way or that. For me, that only goes so far, you know, because ultimately I got into film to say something, not to just, you know, create a living. And the ideal world for everyone is where they can say something and create a living. And we're kind of getting there. But as long as you're pushing towards that goal and you feel aligned, you know, as a couple, I think you can push through and make it. So.
That being said, we're also not scared to get help if we need it. Like, hands down, we've gone to therapy when we need it, and we recalibrate and we refocus on ourselves, and then we move forward and things get crazy again. And, you know, so we take the time we need to, when we need to do it.
Yeah. We this year we had an executive coach. We had someone who was not quite a therapist, but like definitely helped us stay mentally aligned and inspired to work on this. And that was absolutely necessary for us to like make sure that we maintained a healthy, you know, attitude and relationship all year long.
Yeah.
So. I think that is like the modern way for modern couples is like, is understanding that accepting counseling and accepting help in your relationship is not a sign that your relationship is like doomed or is weak or is like on the skids. It's like, if anything, it's like the thing that I think smart couples invest in is taking time to make sure that they're, keeping up on the maintenance, with the thing, and that they're not just going like, well, no, if our relationship's good, then it doesn't need any work. It doesn't need any help, you know? And if we need help or work, then that means our relationship's bad, so we might as well break up anyway. It's like, no, like, a relationship, like, more than any movie or anything else that you're building is, like, it's a big undertaking. It's a massive project that takes...
There definitely is this paradigm shift, and, I mean, we spent some time in Silicon Valley, and I think about it this way, too, where it's, like, it's about, like... It's not about therapy. It's about performance. You know, it's like, people think of themselves as high performing or high, you know, highly, I don't know what you call it. Yeah. High functioning or whatever you want to call it. But like CEOs of company, they have all these people who come in and give them like spiritual guidance and yada, yada, yada. And it's like, yeah, that's, if you shift your mindset to this isn't somebody who's helping fix something that's broken. This is someone who's helping a beautiful, you know, engine keep, you know, like running at its peak, you know, optimal performance levels, then you're like, yeah, all right, cool.
I like
even
that.
If it's not true, it's a great way to think about it.
I gotta have someone come in and just keep my
tune you up,
tune that.
Keep my stuff running tight. Cool. Well, I think that you're both gonna be just great, and I think that your careers, like you're talking about, like we're getting to the place where we're gonna be able to start like making more money doing this and stuff like that. I think you're gonna be just fine. I think anybody that has the ability to take an idea like this from beginning, middle, and end all the way through and actually see it through and push and do all the work that you've been doing, I think you're going to be just fine. And I'm really glad that I got to meet you and that you allowed me to be a small part of this thing, because it's really, really cool. And I felt really, really lucky every single day to be at work and felt really lucky to be a part of this thing. And I think that was kind of a feeling on set, was people felt excited and lucky to be there. Even people who were like, yeah, I'm taking like a bit of a pay cut because it's a smaller budget thing, but like, I'm happy to be here. I don't think that people felt bummed out or like they were getting taken advantage of or anything like that. I think we were all having a really, really good time every single day on set. And I think that I don't see how that's not going to translate in the final product. You know, like that stuff just bleeds into a project, and it's a testament to the two of you and to the work and the passion and the love that you put into the project. And I'm just really excited to see what comes out of it and what you make and then what you do going forward as well. You know?
And my hope is that that's the true story. And it isn't just that we all had a terrible 2020 with this pandemic. And it's like, well, at least I'm out of the house. Thank goodness.
You know? Everyone's jaded because they've been quarantined.
Yeah. It's like, I'm just so happy to be here because, you know, up until now, it was just me and alone with my cat. You know?
This is so much better than making TikToks at home.
Yeah, but I'll take that too if that's the reality. At least we got some money to do something that was better than staying at home in quarantine. So, yeah.
No. Well, right back at you, Austin. You killed it on set, and we were so thrilled to have you, and we were so excited to cast you, and you like brought this light to the character. And every time you were on screen, everyone was just dying. And literally, we watch dailies and everyone's like, oh, he's so good.
Yeah.
That's nice. You guys made me feel good and made me feel like I am okay at my job, which is always nice. So I really appreciate it. And it was really great to get to know the two of you. I hope we do something together again in the future and that we stay tight and we move forward together in fun and exciting ways. Have a good one. And thanks for talking to me on my show.
thanks for having us on the show. This was fantastic.
Uh-huh. It was a blast. Well, go comfort your dogs. And
will do.
I can't wait to get my Alien Country t-shirt in the mail.
Yeah.
It's coming.
Okay. See you later.
Bye.
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 Pretty fun, huh? Not so bad. They're good. They're good people. I'm really happy I got to meet them and I got to work with them. That was a lot of fun, and I'm glad that they wanted to do the podcast as well. I guess it's, you know, free publicity for the movie that won't come out for probably a year, year and a half. That's just part of the process. But man, I mean, it's a crazy business to be in because... people often say that you shouldn't have a plan B, that if you're really going to do this, if you really want to do something as difficult as making it in show business, you can't be setting yourself up with all these lifeboats and impossible escape routes. You have to behave as though it's this or bust. It's this or death. It is this. Like, you are going to make this happen. And you kind of heard them talk about it there in the interview, that they're like, this is the year we're making our movie, no matter what. No matter how many people tell us that it can't be done, no matter how many people, you know, no matter how many roadblocks we hit, we're making our movie. And I do think that to a certain extent, you have to approach a career in show business like that, as though there are no plan Bs and no lifeboats. But Mary and I have been rewatching Veep recently because we're just trying to watch something to make ourselves laugh at the end of the day. And it's a hilarious show. A hilarious show if you've never seen it. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is brilliant on the show. She has this, there's this character, I don't know who the actor's name is, but the character is Dan Egan. He's this staffer on her staff who is this like opportunistic douchebag, this slimy guy who's always kind of got one foot out of the office. He's always sort of like, because he understands that the way that careers work in Washington is like, you can be on the top of the dog pile one day, and then the next day you can be on the bottom. And that's just the way that Washington works. Washington gets shuffled around so often that people are constantly shifting jobs and constantly changing who they work for. So he's always got a BlackBerry full of contacts in case things should go wrong in the Veep's office and he needs to go find a new job. So pretty much every time it looks like there's like an imminent disaster for the Veep, he's already texting new contacts for new possibilities of employment. And it's funny, but I kind of think about a career in show business like that because it's so difficult to get these things done and to get these things made, and because to actually get to the point where you actually get to make a movie, because that is so hard and so unlikely a thing to happen,
When you're beginning these projects, and I'm saying this because I'm currently in the process of trying to get a movie made, and we're in the early stages of, I mean, you heard me talk about this a little bit with Chase Ramsey in his episode about show business. We talked about the fact that we're working on this project together, and this is this movie we're trying to get made, and right now we're in the process of putting together the proof of concept, which is just this. It's basically about a 15-minute long short that we're going to shoot that's going to act as a proof of concept for investors. These are the things I was talking about at the beginning, all the hurdles that you have to get through in order to just get to the point where you can start raising money, and then to get to the point where you can actually have principal photography take place, and then at that point you're still like only halfway done with the marathon. But we're currently, so we are at the very, very, very beginning of the race. And at this point, there are still so many things that could go wrong that could stop this project from happening. But in order for us to have the best shot of success, we all have to behave as though this is happening. And we have to behave and act as though there are no plan Bs, no lifeboats, and not be looking, you know, like we have to perform with the commitment of people who don't have backup plans and to people who need this to work. Kind of like they were saying about putting your own money and your own time and your own investment into a project and the way that we talked about M. Night Shyamalan and stuff. I think that you need to perform and act as though it's this or nothing, but prepare, or at least have some kind of other mindset in some other chamber in your brain. You need to have the practicality and the pragmatism of a person who understands that this is a career with lots of ups and downs, and it's actually more likely that the project won't happen than it is that the project will happen, and that the odds are just stacked against you, and you sort of have to be ready to jump into another project should this project go tits up. You don't prepare for the project to fail. That's the thing. You have to act as though you intend for the project to succeed and to be made, but with the understanding kind of secretly under all that it might not. It probably won't, and you need to be ready to move on to something else. But in the meantime, I am preparing and acting as though this project is happening, because at least this first part of it is happening. We're in the early, early stages of the marathon, and it is a daunting task to approach. But like any daunting task, like any massive thing that people approach, you just do it one day at a time, one step at a time, one small piece of the pie at a time, and hopefully, eventually, you get through it, and you have something neat to show for it on the other end. So keep your eyes and your ears peeled for Alien Country. You can follow Alien Country on Instagram and kind of keep up with where they're at in the process of post-production and all that fun stuff, where Rennie and Boston are at in the editing process. They kind of do fun little updates there. They've been doing a fun viral marketing campaign to sort of save money on marketing. It's a cool thing you can do in this new age of new media. It was great to have them on. And that's it for the show. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. The show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. If you like Chris Bjorn's work by what you can hear on this show, or if you've listened to any of my music and heard my music, Chris Bjorn mixes and masters all of my music, you should, and you're a person who has an audio project, you should go over to marmalademusicslc.com and tell Chris, hey, I listened to your work on People Pleaser, or I heard your work on Austin's album Beautiful Things, or any one of the other things that Chris has mixed and mastered, and tell him you want him to mix and master your project, but drop that name People Pleaser and he's going to give you 20% off your first project. So that's a pretty dope deal. That's a pretty sick deal. And Chris is amongst the best in the biz. So marmalademusicslc.com. Chris will mix and master your project for 20% off if you mention People Pleaser. That's it for me this week. Love you all so much. Thanks for always being here and listening, and be good to each other. Wear your masks out there. We voted. I was saying earlier this year, make sure you vote. Make sure you vote for Joe Biden. We did it, and he won. We're still waiting on half of the country to acknowledge that, but it still happened. So good job, everybody, and goodbye, and I love you, and we'll see you next week.